everything over. Okay, good morning, everybody. I introduce the president of the Old Broadway Synagogue, Dr. Paul Rudensky.
All right, thank you so much. Today is the Your Synagogue,
no talking to me.
That's the way to say it now. In any event, if it's okay with you guys, it would be great if you could dedicate your spirit to this memory.
Oh.
And for an Aliyah to come out for that practice.
100%. Well, keep in mind Rabbi Kret, right up there. That's a beautiful gesture. So just welcome to Seth's mom. Seth's mom is in for a happy occasion. So I don't know if I can say, and I didn't ask permission, I probably should have, but happy birthday to Seth.
Happy birthday, Seth. Today's your birthday, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. How old are you now?
Special birthday wishes to Seth. So what I wanted to speak about this morning, more of a talk or lecture than a formal shiur, is a topic of Judaism's relationship to the environment. We just passed Tu Bishvat. Tu Bishvat is there's a little bit of a chasm between the day, the way that the day is actually observed in practice, and what its initial legal significance was. Of course, our associations with Tu Bishvat here in this country we're sorry to say, somewhat diluted, because it's mainly experienced in Israel. I don't know if anybody else here besides me had the experience of donating to the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, growing up around this time. Laura, you also had that experience? Okay, and Israeli school children traditionally had trips on this day to plant little saplings in Israel, which is obviously very beautiful. And that's a wonderful association, and as we'll see, quite an appropriate one. Of course, in the Jewish legal tradition, the day of Tu Bishvat actually was a crucial day, not altogether dissimilar, as I'll explain in just a second, from April 15th, in our calendar. There is a notion of tithing within the Jewish tradition, all different kinds of tithing, different types of produce. So one specific type of tithing is tithing from trees, from the fruit of trees, and the Mishnah at the very beginning of Tractate Rosh Hashanah explains that the tithing that was done for trees, the line of demarcation, as I'll explain what that means in just a minute, was Tu Bishvat. In other words, you had to keep a fiscal year in the agricultural sense. So just to give one example, let's say a person had an apple orchard, and their apple orchard was producing 10,000 apples a year. I have no idea what the yield of apple orchards, I have no idea whether that's a reasonable number, an unreasonable number. So you would have to tithe based on that number, based on that species, so tithing from your apples, and it would have to be on an annual basis. In other words, to calculate the proper amount that you would have to tithe, and again, if you had 10,000 apples, so 1,000 would be your tithe, so the principle would be that you couldn't take from one year to the next. Okay, so the only question is, how do you measure the year? When should the year start? So we have in the secular calendar, we have all kinds of lines of demarcation. January 1st is the calendar year. The fiscal year might start. When does the fiscal year start?
July
1st, right, the end of the residents in the medical field start July 1, mm-hmm. That's still the proper date, right? The school year usually starts right around September 1. So you have this same concept in halacha, and the Jewish law is when does one mark the year from? So the Mishnah indicates that when it comes to produce of the trees, the year really does begin at Tu Bishvat. That itself is the dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, two major schools. So Beis Shammai was of the view that it's actually the first of Shvat, and Beis Hillel, which became the normative view, says it's the 15th of the month of Shvat. Now, how did they come up with that date? Anybody familiar with the origins of this date? Again, Tu Bishvat is very familiar to us from the planting of trees, but it does have this legal significance, so I'm just trying to trace where this comes from. So the Talmud explains that the winter period, what we call in the rabbinic language, Tekufas Teves, meaning the winter period, essentially lasts for 3 months. So there's Tevet, Shvat, and Adar, and then already Nisan is considered the spring season. So it's a three-month period. Roughly speaking, 30 days in a month, so a 90-day period that we would consider the winter period. So Beis Hillel say is that you measure from the halfway point. Halfway through the winter period, Tevet Shvat Adar, 45 days in, is Tu B'Shvat, is the 15th day of the month of Shvat, and that's when begins the year for the blossoming of trees. Okay, that's the position of Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai says it's the first of Shvat, it's 30 days into the winter period. That obviously seems a little strange. The halfway point might make more sense, that might be the more logical point, but Beis Shammai explains is that because most of the rains of the winter season have already passed, that's when we say the winter season is about over and we begin to count towards the new year as far as the produce of the fruit are concerned. So just one more, what seems like a very technical law, but it's actually of great symbolic philosophical significance, as I'll explain as the shiur develops, is that the way that the demarcation is actually measured, just like we say, like for the tax year, any income which is earned by December 31st, okay, and you have to pay by April 15th. So in the context of tithing from your fruit trees, it's anything, not which came to full growth, but anything which began to blossom. The term in the Hebrew is chanata. Mm-hmm. Anything that began to blossom by the 15th of Shvat is counted towards the previous year. Anything that blossomed after the 15th of Shvat is counted towards the new year. Again, so we follow a line of demarcation which doesn't have to do with necessarily what we can benefit from, but when the fruit first begins to appear. Just keep that in mind as we begin to develop our topic. So you can readily appreciate why Tu B'Shvat, after the laws of tithing were no longer in their full biblical force due to the expulsion of the Jewish people from the land of Israel and a number of other factors involving the population of Jewish people. So Tu B'Shvat's primary association today has to do with trees, the heritage of which is all based on this Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah. Are there any questions just in terms of what the technical laws of Tu B'Shvat are before we expand the discussion? Yeah.
You might say that Aviv would be a more appropriate time when you actually start to see the blossoming done.
Mm-hmm.
Why was Kuvat Tevet? I mean, is there a discussion about why you would choose a date that was, well, proximate to the start of any type of blossoming?
Right, the earliest possible point where, again, you're not even, you know, seeing the fruit in their full growth yet, but we're saying is that, you know, as soon as they begin to blossom, we want to try to schedule the new year that even the beginnings of the blossom are in the new year. So anything which blossomed before that is counted towards the old year. So why do we have such a, to paraphrase Steve's question, why do we have such a front-loaded date? Why do we push it up so much? Why don't we count the new year, you know, when the fruit is actually really ripening and not when it's first blossoming? Again, the date is calculated such that the blossoming itself hopefully will be after the 15th of Shvat. So we're going to come back to that point. I think that's a very significant question.
So, wait, so,
yeah.
Does that mean then, so I understood that Tu B'Shvat is connected to the blossoming of the fruit, but it doesn't actually mean necessarily that the fruit has started to blossom yet.
No,
so in a sense, it's simply an arbitrary date. It's not connected necessarily to botanical observation.
It very much is. So what's the, based on the song, what do we know is the fruit, what blossoms first in Israel right around this time? The Shkedia, the almond tree. So it's a day that's calculated for to try to get in front of all of the blossoming, all of the burgeoning of the first fruits. Again, before they, you know, you ever...
And that's why Shokei.
Very good. Right. Ani Shokei al Dvarila, as we've spoken about in the past in the context of Shavas Arba Tammuz. Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
So in other words, so on the 15th of Shvat, you can assume that we actually won't see any blossoms.
That's the hope. Is that anything that's
we won't see anything. We will not see
right. So that anything
is there before
so that everything can be counted for this year. Right. So that's the question is what exactly does chanata mean? What exactly is blossoming? Are you measuring from the appearance of the first leaf or when the fruit first? It's two opinions in the medieval commentaries.
Because this is relevant because,
you know, the idea is to get it before. Yeah.
Chadash is a different sort of idea, and I guess it's a shlish, so I think we've had a shear a while ago, it's probably not close to 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But that always seems to be more of a problematic reckoning about how you actually measure a third.
Exactly.
Where this is clearly, you're not involved in that sort of question about whether it falls to the previous or up.
Right. That's exactly correct. This is a very, front-loaded point.
The date of the Omer, you don't have a choice to sort of front-load the date.
Exactly, because that's already determined by the Torah. Right. None of this appears in the Bible, exactly what the cutoff should be. This was all given over to the sages to determine the date. Okay, so those are the legal That's the legal etymology, so to speak, of Tu Bishvat, and you can understand why it had implications for trees. To broaden the discussion a little bit, obviously, anytime we reflect on man's relationship, in this case with trees, but the environment more broadly, there are a number of things that come to mind. One is a point of hesitation. When we discuss the proper Judaism's relationship to the environment, it obviously brings up certain pangs, painful feelings, because all the laws that we're discussing right now really were observed. This is what we call mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz, mitzvos that really have to do with the Jewish people's relationship to our homeland, Eretz Yisrael. And while these do touch on universal themes, it's important to at least mention how difficult it is for us to speak about the environment when we're removed from our natural environment. That's not the end of the conversation, but maybe it is the proper beginning to reflect on how detached we are from our natural environment and how important it is to always keep that in mind, even if we can only observe these things in the breach. But beyond that, we obviously have to relate to some of the universal themes which are inherent in man's man's relationship with his environment, which takes us really all the way back to the beginning of Sefer Bereishit. I've had the opportunity to mention on many occasions here the dialectic, which underlies this discussion. Man, long before there was ever the so-called curse that resulted from him eating from the Eitz Hadas, the Tree of Knowledge, a topic to which we'll return, was given a dual command, a dialectical command, to work the earth, le'avda, ulashamra, but at the same time to preserve, to protect, and to conserve. You know, and it really is an amazing thing how this dialectic presages the entire public policy debate that we have today. All of the debate revolves around how to properly balance these two themes. You have your la'avda extremists, people who would, develop and exploit all of the world's natural resources without any thought towards long-term sustainability. La'avda, unchecked by l'shamra, cultivation unchecked, unbridled, without any thought towards l'shamra. And then you have l'shamra extremists who would suspend any meaningful human development in the face of any kind of short-term destruction to the environment, even if it's short-term destruction, which leads to long-term, right? The most classical example of this being sometimes a fire is needed to preserve the forest. These are very basic themes. The notion of short-term and long-term is crucial and is the basic foundation of Judaism's approach to these matters. The need to balance man's development of this world, which we'll talk about as we proceed, with a sense of long-term sustainability. An example I always like to give is there are those people out there who would be willing to, chop down the Amazon rainforest for, a few extra reams of paper. From a Jewish perspective, that's unconscionable, totally unconscionable. That would be an unforgivable neglect of the themes of l'shamra, of the mandate to preserve, to protect, and to conserve. But at the same time, there are those people who, wouldn't allow any kind of exploration which incurs some short-term damage to the environment, even if it's for pursuit of crucial medicines that are essential to the advancement of human civilization. We need to strike this balance. And obviously, this takes a great amount of research and investment to know what the proper balance is. But Judaism's approach here, as is so often the case, is really one of balance. La'avda u'lashamra. Man's first command. Piru revu, be fruitful and multiply. Umilu es ha'aretz, fill the earth. V'chiv shua, subdue it. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote an entire essay, A Lonely Man of Faith, half of which is devoted towards this theme of v'chiv shua, man's mandate given to both Gentile and Jew alike. Lo sohu v'ra'a l'sheves yitzara, the world was not meant to lay fallow, but there is a mandate, a command to develop it. Man must use all of his human resources and all of the natural resources in the world. There's so many wonderful resources that have been buried beneath the surface of the land, of the oceans, which need to be mined and cultivated, but in a proper way, v'chiv shuha, tempered by these themes of l'shamra, the dialectic that man is given at the very beginning of his creation. Man's first action, bespeaks exactly this point. When Adam, when original man, names all of the animals, the Torah tells us that man named all of the animals, and it was a profound moment in the early life of man, because that is the time when man realized that he was alone in the world. Vila Adam lo matza ezer kenegdo. He realized that he had no partner. So it was a moment of his recognition of his ontic loneliness. But at the same time, it was an action that was laden with tremendous meaning. Because if you think about it, the act of man naming all the animals has two implications which are meant to be understood in a complementary fashion. First of all, it underscores man's uniqueness in the cosmos. Man is the pinnacle of creation. He gets to name all of the rest of creation. If all of the world, animal life, plant life, it's all God's creation, but man is only God's true partner. He's the only true partner. Man partners with God. Man is elevated and exalted above the rest of creation. That's why he's given license to name all of the animals. He gets to define creation. They are, as it were, part of his world. He defines them. But at the very same time, this act of naming the animals elevates them. They're transformed from being generic, faceless, nameless brutes to having their own specific identity, an animal identity, but an identity nonetheless. This action both exalts and elevates man and underscores his singularity in the cosmos, but at the very same time exalts the rest of creation in a different sense, gives each animal an identity. Judaism has always underscored our need to appreciate the entire creation, not just in a generic sense, oh how wonderful it is, but with a level of precision and specificity, to appreciate each animal of its own accord. That's the significance of the names of the animals. We should also note that when it comes to our benedictions, our blessings, that we recite over food, both before and after we consume them, they're specific in nature. We don't just make generic blessings, thank God for the food that we eat, but we name the fruits, we name the vegetables, we name, you know, if they're grain products, everything is specified and delineated. And of course, here there's a connection to Israel. Those things which are the special fruits of Israel receive higher level blessings. But the principle of specificity and precision in terms of our appreciation of creation. We are meant to cherish creation, to preserve and to protect it, not just in a generic sense, but each species. Each animal is given a name. Each food that we consume is given a particular blessing. There is a drive towards appreciation in a specific sense. Now, to move forward in our discussion, we need to at least neutralize one very prominent source that seems prima facie to be counter these themes. The famous Mishnah at the end of the third chapter of Pirkei Avos quotes a teaching in the name of Rabbi Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov taught the following Mishnah. He says, if somebody is walking along the path and learning, Hayaholich baderech v'shone, in the rabbinic Hebrew, umafsik mimishnaso, and he ceases his learning, v'omer, and he says, mana'a ilan zo, how aesthetically pleasing is this tree, mana'a dir zo, how marvelous, how breathtaking is this field, harezeh, havizeh, ki ilu mischayev benafsho, it is as if he's liable for his life. So again, this seems totally counter to the themes that we're discussing, right? Somebody who's walking along the path and learning, what more, you know, can't imagine a more pastoral scene than this. You know, he's walking along the path, speaking in Torah study with his friend, and he comments what a beautiful creation that God has made, and we're going to sentence this person to even theoretical death. I mean, what more anti-environmentalist, I mean, horrifying at first, it seems. Right? We would all agree that this is... that this source at least has to be neutralized. I mean, this is pretty bad, or at least it seems that way. So,
you're learning and
okay. So Avi does.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I agree. That's a problem. If we're meant to understand this the way that it sounds, then we're all in deep trouble, and we could probably all go home now, and conclude that you know, appreciation of the environment is apparently not one of our cardinal values or virtues. It's more like a vice. So the truth of the matter is that if you...
Drill.
What's that?
Drill baby drill.
Drill baby drill.
Right. She was on TV.
Exactly. So You know, by the way, so that's what I was alluding to before. When you talk about the need to balance, you know, developing the world with a long-term strategy. And that's something that we'll return to moving forward. So it was pointed out to me by my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Michael Rosenzweig, that if you read the Mishnah carefully, that's actually not what the Mishnah is saying at all. The Mishnah is making precisely the opposite point. You just have to read it, as is always the case, with extreme care. So let's just go back over the words. Rabbi Yaakov Omer, Rabbi Yaakov said, Hayaholech baderech veshone, a person is walking along the path and learning. Umafsik mimishnaso, and he actively ceases his learning. Veomer mana ilanzo, and then he says, how aesthetically pleasing is this tree? The crucial point is, I see Seth nodding sagaciously out of my... What's that? I said out of my peripheral vision. I see Seth nodding sagaciously. So what's the crucial point?
Well, you could take it a couple of ways. First is that he interrupts before he says it. Another is that maybe what he should be saying is mana ilanzo as part of his learning. He should be saying, how beautiful is this tree? That shouldn't be, he shouldn't even consider it an interruption.
Exactly. That the problem here is the hefsek. If the Mishnah wanted to underscore the problem is paying attention to the environment when you should be focused on learning, then the idea really, the Mishnah should say, Hayaholich baderech v'shone, you're walking along the way and learning, ve'omer mana ilanzo, hareza mischaya benafsho. But here the crucial point is, umafsik mimishnaso, that you interrupt, that a person who fails to integrate and to see that all of the study that we do is part of the same theme of appreciating God's world, different parts of God's creation. There's God's creation in terms of values that we have to access through the Torah. But there's also God's creation in terms of God's actual creation. And if you don't see those as integrated, as being part of one unified whole, if you have this kind of inappropriate bifurcation of your spiritual world, that's an unforgivable crime. That's Hareza Kilu Mischaya Benafsho. We point towards integration, that you should see your appreciation of the beautiful world, you know, Melochol Haaretz Kivodo, the entire world is filled with God's glory, as a natural outgrowth of all the things that we're trying to learn from our Torah study. And not only that, I would say that it works in the other direction as well. In other words, that the more we appreciate God's natural environment, the more that we see His majesty and elegance in creation itself, the more inspired, and this of course is something the Rambam speaks about at length, the more inspired we should be to come to know Him better through the sources as well. These are all ways of coming closer to God, of Yediyas Hashem, of coming to know the Almighty God. The more inspired we are by His creation, by the cosmos, the more deeply we should yearn to know His values as well. Okay, so these are... I think that source, if this is the correct interpretation, then has been thoroughly neutralized. And if anything, what it really does is encourages a balanced religious person, the integrated, complete religious person, to seek God's wisdom in all areas of human existence, both in study and as well as in natural observation. These can be and really should be spiritual activities when we go. Particularly beautiful places. I don't have to mention here, it really goes without saying, but that's why Judaism always records specific blessings for natural events. Thunder and lightning and seeing a large ocean or seeing a beautiful sight, these things all get their special blessings. And the idea, of course, is that this is not divorced from religious experience, but this can in a certain sense be a climax of the religious experience. The famous story... you know, obviously he didn't say it to me because we missed each other about 150 years. You know, of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch saying that he was going to vacation in the Alps. They said, you know, why do that? And of course he said, because when I get upstairs, God will ask me, did you see my Alps? And if not, why not? Did you have something better? So, but that perspective of wanting to take it all in, to appreciate the majesty of creation, to be sensitive, and again, not just in a generic sense, but the more we know about it, the more precisely we appreciate it. I'm making a pitch for specificity here, for precision, for really paying attention to the details. The beauty really, so often is the case, is in the details when you appreciate the micro as well as the macro. If you know, all the geological layers and these things, the specialists can tell us about. Okay, so those are some... some crucial themes. You know, we mentioned the need to balance short-term development with a long-term perspective. Obviously, if human life is in immediate danger, anything should be done. Anything should be done to preserve that human life. But in most cases of policy, what we're really measuring, of course, is not things which are only of immediate concern, but things which will affect man for many, many years to come. The Torah tells us, this is all the way towards the end of the Torah in the book of Deuteronomy, the Torah is describing a war scene, a war scenario, and in one of these jus in bellum, the Latin term, there are certain kinds of laws of war, rules of engagement. And the Torah describes there a fascinating law that ki tatzar elir lihi lachem alaha, when you besiege a city, so all kinds of laws that apply. And one of the laws that the Torah specifies at that point is that if one encounters a fruit tree, which is a life-sustaining force, there's an iser d'oraisa, there's a Torah-level prohibition against cutting down that fruit tree. And the Torah says there, famously, ki ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh. There is some basic equation, as it were, between man and the tree of the field. Now, what exactly this means is obviously somewhat of a cryptic remark, and the various Rishon and the medieval commentaries do interpret in various ways. But the Torah, at its simplest root, is saying is that even, and here's where the context is crucial, even in a situation, a violent situation, where there's a tremendous risk of a loss of humanity, kind of a violent, the violent side of man emerging, what my grandfather used to always refer to, based on his war experiences, as the thin veneer of civilization. When that is at risk, so there's unfortunately a capacity that man has to totally lose his sense of bearing, his moral compass. And the Torah reminds us at that point, it's not an accident that it's in this context that the need to have a preservationist instinct comes up. The Torah says, no. Destruction is always a necessary evil. And it's specifically in this context that I remind you that wanton destruction is totally abhorrent to us. Not only of human life, but even of plant life. And therefore, if even in this war situation, if you see this tree, this fruit tree, which is a life-sustaining force, remind yourselves of the value of life by making a point of preserving this tree. It's again, the context here is crucial. At a time when human life, when the value of human life is most vulnerable, is most likely to be eroded and diluted, that's precisely when the need to reinforce those themes, preservationist themes, is at its most crucial. In this connection, I think it's quite moving and poignant to refer to a Nagadata, a homiletic passage in Tractate Tinus, this is on page 23a, which I've referred to in the past. It's one of my favorite Gemaras. The Gemara there is describing Choni Hamagel, who was a very colorful and remarkable figure, who's most famous for praying for rain, refusing to budge out of a circle until God complied to bring rain. And then in an ongoing discussion of his character, the Gemara says as follows. He was walking along the way, and he saw an individual planting a charuva, a carob tree. And anybody, according to the Gemara, I'm not sure that this what the botanists have to say about this, but according to the Gemara, anybody know how long it takes for the carob tree to bear fruit?
70 years.
70 years, exactly, right. Very good, Steve. So he turns to the guy and he says, you know, this is like an act of remarkable presumptuousness. Do you imagine that you'll be around in 70 years to reap the fruits of this carob tree? And the man said, well, probably not, but there were carob trees when I came into the world. That means that somebody planted them for me. And kishem sheshat li liavhasi, just as my father's director, you know, ancestors in the more expansive sense, just as they planted for me, kach eshasel livirai, so too I will plant for my children. Can't say it any better than that. This notion of the spiritual personality understands that as much as we're meant to enjoy the world, and we are, and here we always make reference to the famous Yerushalmi, which says that a man not only is has to stand judgment before the heavenly tribunal about, you know, that which he did which was wrong, and that's which he benefited from this world inappropriately, unfairly, that's which he took which is not his. A man stands judgment in front of the heavenly tribunal for all those things that he should have benefited from, and he failed to benefit. The world is for our benefit, but there's always a long-term perspective, which is crucial here. In other words, you can't only think. A spiritual personality doesn't only think in terms of today. He also thinks in terms of his children and his grandchildren. Just as my forefathers planted for me, I'll plant for future generations. The Talmud goes on to describe that Choni fell asleep for 70 years. Okay, this is, if Rip Van Winkle was 20 years, right? Okay, 3.5x. If Rip Van Winkle is X. So 3.5 times Rip Van Winkle. And he wakes up and he sees people eating from the carob tree. So he says, ah, you must be the guy that, you know, we spoke a mere 70 years ago. And they say, oh no, that was our grandfather. It's a very poignant and homiletic end to the passage, is basically meaning that exactly what this guy envisioned, his vision of the future was a powerful one. There really is such a thing as tomorrow. And the spiritual personality is oriented towards tomorrow. We have no license to only think in terms of today. This has to be a watchword for us. Just as our forefathers made sure there was something for us, so too we have to make sure that there's something left for future generations. So these themes that we're discussing, number one, having a sense of God's majesty through creation, having an instinct towards preservation, not just in the general sense, but of each and every species. That's why all the animals were given a name. That's why we bless, not just in the generic, but each particular species that God gave us. There's a notion of preserving creation in its own sense as something of inherent value. But then even as we develop that creation, we have to be mindful that we're not the last human beings that are meant to walk this planet. That's why la'avda, the need to develop and to cultivate, and v'chivshua, to use all of our natural and human resources to develop the world, always has to be offset and balanced and viewed through the long-term lens of l'shamra. These are crucial perspectives. I just want to conclude by making reference to something I said we would get back to, this notion of chanata. What is the crucial time point? From when do we measure the tree's year? We said from the blossoming. Now, what's interesting about this is that there's another time point that could have recommended itself. What we could have tried to do is to try to say, okay, we want to schedule the new year to coincide with when we'll actually be picking the fruits. That would have been a much more anthropocentric time point to choose, right? Because when do humans benefit from the fruits? Humans benefit from the fruits for the first time when? When we pick them. And it wouldn't be unheard of to choose that. In fact, when it comes to yirakos, when it comes to vegetables, that is the time point that we more or less use. It depends which one, but when it comes to vegetables, we try to start the year right around the time that we would be picking those vegetables. So what is this chanata time point all about? It's a time point which doesn't bespeak human, when a human can benefit, but it actually is a much more, what I would call, ecocentric time point. We mark the first fruits. We try to start the fruit year not when we're going to benefit from them, but when they first come into existence. In other words, it's our way of saying long before we're going to benefit, these things have value, and we have to appreciate that. I always thought that was a powerful symbolic statement. In other words, the details of the halacha here reflect a perspective, a philosophical perspective. Philosophical perspective being is that we don't only look at a tree and see, you know, food. You know, we look at the tree and see creation. Yes, creation that benefits us, but also God's majesty, something inherently beautiful, and we have to sensitize ourselves to that. That's a very, very rich, that, in other words, the detail here, this detail of chanata, of the blossoming of the fruit, and not the time when the fruit would actually be subject to our benefit, that itself bespeaks a kind of ecocentric perspective. The notion that we've developed today, the need for balance, I think is moving and important in its own right, but it also is a classical example of what makes the Torah, you know, it doesn't need my endorsement. But I think I'm often overwhelmed simply by this idea that, you know, if you pay attention to the public policy debate today, It's just remarkable to me that two words in the Torah, very much at the beginning, in Sefer Bereishit in one pasuk, put next to each other, La'avdo L'shamra, encapsulate the very best of what it is we're striving for. A movement towards balance, towards balancing different competing values of human, the need for the human being to be singular, to marshal all of the resources in this world for his benefit, but to do so in a responsible way. I can't think of a more cogent and efficient way, la'avdo l'shamra, of encapsulating everything it is that people are trying to figure out today. Obviously, you have to work out the details, but in terms of a pole star, what are our values? What are the values which underlie this conversation? The Torah insists on the singularity of man. Man is at the pinnacle of creation. Man is the only being endowed with Tzelem Elohim. Everything is God's creation, but man is still unique, uniquely inspired with this divine spark. He is, I always like to say, as I mentioned before, everything is God's creation, but man is God's only partner. Man is unique, therefore that gives man license to utilize creation, but also the responsibility to preserve it. And the balance of those two values is exactly what we're striving for. Okay, that has to be our perspective, and it's just one of these great examples that, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Hafoch ba v'hafoch ba dechula ba, look into the Torah, look into the Torah, because all is in there. What it really means is that all of the values that we need to be armed with when we go out into the world and try to formulate responsible social policy, all of those values are inherent already in our most sacred text in the Torah. Okay, so we'll hold it up there.